This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Reliable numbers are hard to pin down, but it's probably safe to say that tens of millions of Americans are in chronic pain. Until relatively recently, doctors tended to prescribe little in the way of relief. Opiates like morphine were usually reserved for short-term crises or for the terminally ill, and even then there was concern about addiction and the dangers of overprescribing. Now pain specialists say they can manage their patients' suffering with large doses of drugs, and particularly the fairly new synthetic opioid, OxyContin. But powerful treatment can also be a powerful temptation. OxyContin has long since left the hospital narcotics cabinet to become a popular street drug, nicknamed hillbilly heroin. The Drug Enforcement Administration has prosecuted a number of doctors who it says run pill mills, dispensing huge numbers of prescriptions that put thousands of pills in the hands of drug dealers. But many doctors worry that the DEA has gone too far. For fear of legal problems, fewer doctors are choosing the specialty of pain management, and some patients worry that they will lose the access to their medication. Later in this program, a look at the unique political culture of Louisiana, which elected its first woman governor over the weekend, and your letters. But first, the difficult balance between legal and illegal uses of OxyContin. If you're a patient or if you're a doctor dealing with these issues, or if you've had experience on the street side of OxyContin, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now from his practice in New York City is Dr. Norman Marcus. He's former president of the American Academy of Pain Medication. He runs the Norman Marcus Pain Institute in Manhattan. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Welcome. Thank you.
Tell us.
One correction. It's the American Academy of Pain Medicine.
Ah, please excuse me.
Okay.
Tell us a little bit about OxyContin family of drugs, opioids.
Well, OxyContin is a long-acting drug in the morphine family, and it's a sustained-release oxycodone. Oxycodone might be better known to the listeners as the active ingredient in Percocet.
Mm-hmm.
So people have used Percocet for many years. Then it came out in this long-acting form, which would be useful for people who had chronic pain, meaning pain that's always going to be there. And the thought is, if it's always going to be there, why not use a drug that allows you to take less frequent dosing than every 4 hours, so that you have something here with OxyContin which lasts for 8 hours. And that was the utility of developing and presenting this new drug.
Mm-hmm. Now, OxyContin is, of course, addictive.
Well, addiction is something that can occur with Tylenol. I had a patient who was addicted to Tylenol. Addiction is a psychological state. It's not the physiological state that we're talking about when we talk about dependence. So what we need to do is get some step back a moment and start to talk about definitions.
Okay.
Addiction is the preoccupation of having and taking the drug in spite of adverse consequences of taking the drug. That's not the proper use of the drug, where the body becomes dependent, which will occur to any human being who takes a drug around the clock in the morphine family for more than 5 days. The body gets used to it, mm-hmm. and that's called dependence. That's not addiction.
Now, what does happen to patients who do take these drugs for a long period of time? You mentioned 5 days. Some people are on it quite a bit longer than that.
Their bodies become dependent on it. That's not addiction.
Does the effect stay the same? Don't they have to take more and more?
No. Tolerance develops in some patients. We don't know why it develops in some patients and not in others. Tolerance, for the audience, is the need to take more medication of the same sort to get the same effect. And that happens because of the physiological response of the body to taking this type of drug. But it doesn't occur in everyone, and when it does occur, you can give the person more medication.
Mm-hmm. So simply more, and that doesn't cause any medical problems?
No. You see, the thing with morphine and that type of drug is there's no upper limit. You say, what? Won't you die if you take too much?
Yeah, won't you die if you take too much?
No. As long as you take it in rational increments. So, for example, if I started someone out who had never been on the drug before, I would start out in a very low level of the drug. Let's say for morphine, 5 to 10 milligrams of injectable equivalent.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be somewhere between 15 to 30 milligrams of oral morphine. And then I would go up in like 20% increments until the person had pain relief. And you would say, well, where would you stop? You don't stop until you get pain relief.
Now, doctors have to be licensed to prescribe these drugs. Is it a special license or it's every doctor?
Well, every doctor conceivably has the right to write the drug, but there are special licenses called, narcotic licenses that mm-hmm. are given by the government, and you have to apply for that.
Now, there is a strong black market for OxyContin. How do you screen for doctors who might become potential abusers, or for patients, for that matter, who might become potential abusers?
I think it's more important to screen for the doctors who are undertreating the patients who are suffering in agony with pain needlessly. The biggest problem is really the one of undertreatment, not of diversion. That's a tiny problem compared to the numbers of patients who are inadequately treated and who have to go through life, you know, feeling like they're pariahs. I had a patient who came to me who was spending $3,000 a month on the street to get his drugs. He's a guy in his mid-40s who needed a knee replacement, and it's much too early in your mid-40s to get a knee replacement, and his family doctor wouldn't give him the medication. And I examined him. He had a very legitimate problem, and I gave him a prescription. And now he doesn't spend $3,000 a month on drugs. He spends it on his family. He has three kids and a wife, and he works full-time, and he can function well. So the problem really needs to be put into perspective. Are there bad doctors? Yes. Does it represent the major reflection of the industry? Absolutely not.
Do you hear from colleagues who are less willing to go into the specialty of pain?
Absolutely, for a number of reasons. I mean, there's not a constituency supporting pain medicine. Less than 5% of the medical schools even have organized courses on pain medicine. We don't have any structured approach that has universal acceptance in examining the patient. We don't even have a physical examination that we all agree upon. So that we have a lot of stuff that's going on in the field of medicine where it's like the Tower of Babel, that different doctors from different specialties seeing the same patient come up with different diagnoses and then come up with different treatments. And no wonder that we have real problems in terms of pain treatment in the United States. In overall, it's costing about $100 billion a year for the treatment of chronic pain in the United States. For back pain, $20 billion for that condition alone. And a lot of this has to do with overutilization of high technology, lack of a uniform way of evaluating patients, and the overuse of the treatments relying on high technology.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address, totn@npr.org. And let's go to Alan, who's on the line with us from Oakland, California.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Alan.
Hi, I'm a psychiatrist in Oakland who treated patients, some with chronic pain. Unfortunately, I also developed chronic pain after a patient assaulted me with a rifle and a pistol one time,
mm-hmm.
and developed a rotator cuff tear and went to a chronic pain management specialist out here. And I was initially treated with levodromaran, another opiate, quite successfully, but he switched me to OxyContin, and I did develop an addiction to it. And this came about only after a couple of years. This came about after I was under a lot of stress during a divorce. And I initially found the drug very helpful, and I was quite functional and didn't realize until others around me noticed I was not functioning as well. And it's quite a problem because although I found it very helpful for some of my patients, I was not aware of my own impairment and needed to go into detox and rehab and lost my private practice. And although now I'm doing quite well and doing community mental health and working in a county facility, and I think it's just a problem in terms of recognizing appropriate and inappropriate use. And I think it's important to have programs like this to demonstrate the use of a drug that's quite powerful and at times effective, but in the wrong hands, quite damaging.
Dr. Marcus?
Yeah. What you say really would have occurred with levodromarin as well as it would have occurred with OxyContin. There's nothing particularly addictive about any one opioid. They're all the same. What was most telling about what you said was that you used it to deal with the stress in your life, and that's where the addiction came in. You were medicating yourself against the stress that you were going through in relationship with your divorce, and that was the inappropriate use of the medication. When that happens, that's where the addiction occurs. And when you say not a very long time, 2 years is a very long time, but for the first couple of years, it didn't seem to be problematic. When it became interwoven with problems having to do with a psychological nature, and this became your psychological drug, then it was a problem.
Yeah. Alan, congratulations for dealing with it in any case.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much for the call. Let's get another caller in. This is Mark, who's with us from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hello, Mark, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hello, Dr. Marcus. Hi. I am calling with a comment and then a question. My comment is, it seems to me that you know, addictionologists, or I should say pain specialists, are kind of eventually become addictionologists. I'm a general internist, and about 5 months ago I had a discectomy that went really quite bad, and I have a large area of fibrosis and a lot of pain, and went through some OxyContin, and of course, like everyone, I think it's a great drug, but I didn't want to be on it for the name, and eventually my pain specialist put me on Duragesic, and I would like, the comment is isn't it that with addiction, and I'm not really clear, but isn't it more or less addictive if someone has the same amount of a pharmaceutical or a drug delivered rather than a intermittent bolus? And if that is true, is there going to be a long-acting oxycodone that cannot be broken down so easily and abused so easily also?
And if you'd, in the course of answering that, tell us what a bolus is, we'd appreciate it.
Okay, well, what the question has to do with is delivering the drug in a steady way, like this gentleman's wearing a patch, and the patch is putting the drug through his skin, and then it's being picked up by the bloodstream. But the patch is on there all the time. So he wears it for 3 days, and then he takes it off and puts on a new patch. Now, that's one route of administration. Another route of administration would be the OxyContin, which is every 8 hours, MS-Contin every 12 hours. Then there are other drugs like Cadian, which is every 24 hours. So we have long-acting medication for patients who are in pain all the time. The question of will you become more addicted with one route or another route doesn't seem to be the relevant question. The question is, do you have an addictive personality? Is removing yourself from reality better than being in reality? Is your life too painful so that you would rather take a drug than face the pain of your life emotionally? And that's really the issue that we have to look at when we look at people who want to abuse drugs. If you think about your audience or have your audience ask themselves, do you like it if you were drunk all the time? Well, you have these people who relish being high on the medication like to be altered. Most of us, thank God, don't like to be altered, that we may like to have a drink on a weekend or in the evening, but we don't want to feel that way all day long, where someone who's on these drugs wants to be altered,
Mark,
whether they're conscious of it or not conscious of it.
Mark, thank you very much for the call. And doctor, thank you very much for being with us today. Norman Marcus runs the Norman Marcus Pain Institute in New York City. Another view when we come back from a break. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the struggle to find a balance in the regulation of a prescription pain medication called OxyContin. How do you make this available to those in need while keeping it out of the hands of abusers? The problem has been in the news, of course. Last month, radio talk show host Rush Limbaugh announced to his listeners that he was addicted to OxyContin and promptly checked himself into a treatment center. Today, Mr. Limbaugh returned to the radio and had this to say about his fight with the drug.
I tried to treat myself twice for my addiction. I detoxed myself twice and tried to do it by force of will, which is not possible. This is something someone cannot do alone. It's something that requires several things to change in my life. And those things are good. These things are quite necessary, and I have to put this recovery that I am in first and foremost.
If you have experience with OxyContin and other pain prescriptions, either as a patient or a user or as a doctor, call us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is Barry Meyer, a reporter for The New York Times and the author of the new book, Painkiller, A Wonder Drug's Trail of Addiction and Death. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil.
Before the break, we were listening to Dr. Marcus talk about the legitimate need for OxyContin. Your book traces a very different history for the drug. It's illicit use.
Right. I try to actually trace a path that involves both its illicit and illicit use. And Dr. Marcus is right in his earlier comments. There is a real Tower of Babel here, but unfortunately it's a Tower of Babel that affects the medical profession very deeply as well. I mean, at this point in time, we know very little about what percentage of people will become addicted to these drugs, even through medical treatment. We know that most patients can use these drugs successfully, but we really don't know how many people will go on to abuse them and become addicted to them.
Mm-hmm.
Just as importantly, while he spoke to several of your callers about their emotional problems, many people will walk into a doctor's office and have an underlying substance abuse disorder that can be triggered by the drug that they're prescribed by a doctor. It's not like they're coming in with their psychological problems on their sleeve.
From your experience, do the people who would buy OxyContin on the street, would they, you know, just say, "Ooh, that's an interesting new drug, try that," or did they develop a habit from their doctor?
The majority of people that tried it on the street were trying it on the street. There were kids, there were teenagers who got this drug because it was widely prescribed. It was probably the most widely prescribed narcotic of its strength and power that's come out in recent medical history. That's what made it so available both in doctors' offices and on the streets.
Well, how big a problem is it?
It's a significant problem. I mean, drugs like OxyContin, prescription narcotics, are the most widely abused prescription drugs at the moment, and deaths in certain parts of this country involving overdoses from these drugs outnumber those involving illicit drugs like heroin. So we have a tremendous problem with the misuse of these drugs, and we may also have problems with the use of these drugs because Rush Limbaugh, from what I understand it, went to his doctor as a pain patient, not as a drug seeker.
Mm-hmm. Let's get another caller on the line. Shane is with us from Minneapolis.
Yeah, hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with your guest there that it's quite easy to get the drugs or OxyContin specifically.
Do you know that from personal experience?
Yeah, I used to have an addiction which started with Dilaudid, another prescription drug. But the OxyContin, which was available then, wasn't my favorite, so I didn't do it as much. But I did. I was an IV user, and I did a large dose my first time, and it could have been disastrous, but luckily, I guess I had a tolerance built up.
Hmm. Shane, I'm glad it didn't turn out badly for you. How much does it cost per dose?
I guess some people, the street prices can get pretty high, but for, I guess, one dose, if you're just to get high,
mm-hmm.
it's not more than $10.
And how does that compare to if you wanted to buy heroin, for example?
It's probably a little cheaper in general. It depends, where you're getting your drugs from. but it's definitely much more reliable.
Barry Meyer?
Yes, I mean, this drug, OxyContin, sort of became the gold standard on the street, and people, unfortunately, who were both IV drug users, got a hold of it. But I think more importantly, it was teenagers. It was kids. It was not kids who were not traditional drug users who got access to this drug and who became addicted to it and who developed problems from it and who will be developing problems for the rest of their lives as a result of it.
Mm-hmm. Shane, I hope you're off all that stuff.
Yep, I did. I went through treatment, and I've been clean for close to 2 years now.
Well, congratulations.
So, thank you very much.
Okay, appreciate the phone call, though.
All right, good day.
Barry Meyer, to what degree do doctors contribute to the problem that Shane was just talking about, that this is available on the street?
Doctors don't contribute consciously to this in the most part. I mean, doctors are very well-meaning, but doctors don't necessarily have the tools or the time to deal with chronic pain patients. As your earlier guest said, number one, there's very little agreement about how pain patients should be treated. Number two, they're not diagnostic tools to recognize a patient coming in into an office that may have an underlying substance abuse problem. And most doctors don't have the time nor the patience to monitor patients' use of these drugs.
Right.
So you've got a small constituency of pain specialists like Dr. Marcus who are familiar with this area. Then you've got the large bulk of physicians who are well-meaning, who aren't that familiar with it. And then you've got a small cadre of bad actors, doctors who run pill mills and basically sell scripts for cash.
From what you've seen, is prosecution of doctors by the DEA, is it going overboard? Are they targeting the right people?
Well, I don't know whether they're targeting the right people or the wrong people, but certainly those people that, doctors that engage in this activity ought to be taken out of business. I mean, they've got no business being doctors. They essentially are sociopaths.
Let's get another caller in. Jean joins us from Reno, Nevada.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling to put in my vote in favor of OxyContin as someone who has recently been on it. I was in a very bad horse accident. I fell off my mare at a full gallop in early August. When I hit the ground, I fractured thoracic vertebrae, ribs, many ribs. I ended up in the hospital, had to be helicoptered in. I ended up with severe damage to myself in that I lost many, many pints of blood internally into my skin. My limbs were extended and I was full of edema. In the hospital, I was taking fentanyl, which is a drug that was administered intravenously.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a button that I could control that with, but I was so out of it that I kept forgetting to use the button, which made me start cycling into pain cycles that eventually turned into panic attacks and respiratory issues.
And OxyContin helped that?
No. Where I'm coming from on this is when I got released from the hospital, the drug that was prescribed for my recuperation was OxyContin. And that allowed me, that kept my pain level so steady for 8 hours at a time that the panic attacks ceased. I was able to sleep, rest. I was able to become level. I was able to heal. And when it was done, I stopped taking the OxyContin and I was healed. But without the OxyContin, I would have been in a much worse position and in god-awful pain, which was stopping me from being able to recover.
Thanks very much, Gene. I appreciate it. Barry Meyer, obviously there are, Gene and other many people like her, have there's very legitimate uses for this drug.
Absolutely, and this is a legitimate drug, and it sounds like Gene's use of it was perfectly appropriate, and her pain is the type of serious pain for which this drug is really good for and works very well for. The problem came when, this drug was being marketed. Initially it was also being marketed let me put it this way. Initially, doctors are also prescribing it sort of for very transient pain, for, pain that lasted a couple of days. It was originally intended to sort of be the last line of defense in pain treatment to treat patients like Gene. And then slowly it started getting, kind of pushed up to the front lines, and its availability mushroomed as a result of that.
Well, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
It was my pleasure.
Barry Meyer is the author of Painkiller, A Wonder Drug's Trail of Addiction and Death. He's a reporter with the New York Times and spoke with us from their offices in Manhattan. As the debate over pain medication continues, doctors and law enforcement must now deal with each other across a blurry battle line separating the needs of patients from demands for public safety. One of the people who keeps a close eye on that division is Sandra Johnson, director of the Mayday Project at the American Society for Law, Medicine, and Ethics, also a professor at St. Louis University School of Law. She joins us now from her office in St. Louis, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. Hello, Neil.
Where is the balance lie between the needs of the patient, Jean was just talking to us, and drug policy right now?
Well, I think we have to look at both of those issues as health issues rather than criminal issues, and that would take us a long way. Because what we're seeing is an increasing in criminalization of physician judgment in this area. So if you look at what we've heard today about the difficulties of medical research, some of the ambiguities of how to treat patients, when we try to use criminal law, arresting physicians, handcuffing physicians as a way of getting into this issue, we're going in the wrong direction.
Well, how many physicians have been handcuffed?
Well, there's not many that have been arrested, that's for sure, across the country. The DEA put out data that says that they've done 557 investigations in the first quarter of 2003. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot unless you're a doctor treating pain patients. And the issue here partly is that doctors are hypersensitive to legal risk. Then they will change their practices based on what they fear about legal action. And we could say that they should get over this. They should just accept that as part of their practice. But the problem is it has very negative impacts on patient care. And it's not an irrational fear. All you have to do is see one of your colleagues, practice destroyed, reputation destroyed, patients not being cared for, and that's a lesson that those doctors will take home.
Yet, on the other side, there is an awful lot of OxyContin on the street.
There may be a lot of OxyContin on the street. I wonder, too, whether we don't have some over-reporting of OxyContin injuries and deaths because of the high media coverage of it, because the DEA has made it their number one drug product to go after. So there is a public health issue with OxyContin on the street. That's true. So we need a balance in approaching this, and there's no doubt. You know, there are doctors that are good doctors and practice excellent medicine in treating their pain patients, and there are some doctors that are really good doctors, but sometimes they make mistakes in medicine. And then you have a few criminal doctors. But do you want the whole system to focus on the criminal doctors and in the meantime freeze those other doctors into taking care of patients badly?
Mm-hmm. Obviously, though, don't doctors have a responsibility to try to make sure their patients use drugs they prescribe properly?
Yes, they have a responsibility, and I think they can do it in most cases by simply engaging in good practice management techniques, performing physical exams, having a treatment plan, evaluating the patient on an ongoing basis, documenting all of their relationship. So I think physicians can do this, and most do this, and that really will go a long way to protecting them from legal action and to engaging in good practice. Still, the report of pain is a subjective report. So if I come in and say, I have pain, and I have this much pain from my knee, I may be suffering more than another person with it, but that doesn't make it less real. And that's the problem with that physicians face in evaluating pain patients.
We're speaking with Sandra Johnson of the St. Louis University Law School. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a caller on the line. Gerard is with us from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Your current specialist is very interesting, and I appreciate the opportunity to rebut some of her comments. We've been focusing on OxyContin, but there are a slew of other drugs, including hydrocodone, which is OxyContin without time release, that is readily available on the Internet. There are a slew of prescription drugs that are highly addictive that you can simply obtain by clicking on one of the pharmacy nets. You will set up a consultation with one of the pharmacy's doctors, and they will issue you a script for a $100 online or $150 online patient consultation, and then you've got 2 or 3 months' worth of prescriptions, and you can do that time and time and time again. And I have experience on that because I happen to be the spouse of someone who has suffered from that. Now, I can assure you there are more than a handful of doctors that practice this technique. And frankly, those are the doctors that should be put to jail, period, paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's who the FDA, the Department of Drugs, should go after. Thank you.
Before we let you go, Gerard, how is your wife doing?
She is. We tried two interventions and two stays with in drug rehab. Both of them failed, and she finally has gone to Betty Ford and has completed the program successfully, as she did the previous programs. And now all we have to do is wait and see. She is a severe, a chronic pain sufferer, and frankly, the chances of rehab are not the greatest as a result of that.
Well, will you wish her the best of luck from us, please?
Certainly.
Thank you. And hang in there, will you?
All right.
Appreciate the phone call. Get a response, Sandra Johnson?
Yeah, actually, I couldn't agree with Gerard more. He's absolutely right. Because when you look at the internet prescribing that he describes of these kinds of drugs, they're being prescribed without any physical exam, without any treatment plan. They do not meet even the merest standards of physician practice management that I mentioned. So the type that he describes, absolutely, I agree with him. In fact, in many states, that kind of prescribing is illegal, and California just levied a multi-million dollar fine against seven doctors who were prescribing on that basis. So that's a target that I think is very worthwhile, and that would be worth putting resources up against.
Should there be more communication? We just have about a minute and a half left before we have to let you go. But should there be more communication between the DEA and the medical community to resolve some of these problems?
Yes, absolutely. And there was a start at that in 2001. There was a joint statement issued by the DEA and several of the specialty organizations that, in which the administrator of the DEA said they do not want to discourage patients from using OxyContin. That's not their target. Now, later in the next year, they said that they've established an unprecedented and aggressive national action plan against OxyContin. So there's a little bit of an ambiguity in their current position, but I think the dialogue on a national level between the DEA and the specialty organizations, but then also in each DEA, in each region of the DEA, with the local state medical boards to make sure that we keep treating this like a medical issue, because that's what it is.
Sandra Johnson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sandra Johnson, a law professor at St. Louis University and director of the May Day Project at the American Society for Law, Medicine, and Ethics. She joined us from her office in St. Louis. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll speak with the head of the Drug Enforcement Task Force in Ohio to get a better idea of the law enforcement side of this. And we want your phone calls, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today we're discussing the use and abuse of prescription painkillers, in particular OxyContin, and our phone number is 800-989-8255. As doctors struggle to adequately treat their patients, law enforcement officials around the country have to deal with the increasing popularity of prescription pain drugs on the street. Joining us now is John Berkey, head of the Drug Enforcement Task Force in Ohio, vice president of the National Association of Drug Diversion Investigators, or NADDI, which is having its annual convention in Fort Lauderdale right now. He joins us from his hotel there. Good of you to take the time to be with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Where do you come down on before the break, we were listening to Sandra Johnson say this is really much more of a health issue, an issue for the medical community, and law enforcement has been overzealous.
Well, I mean, I guess I wish it was that easy. I think there's a couple things here, and that is that what I think is important, and I think one of the other callers mentioned it, is balance. And that is that somehow we all have the same goal. At least I hope we do, and that is to certainly do what we can to curb drug diversion, but at the same time somehow try to safeguard those people that are legitimate pain patients.
Mm-hmm.
And that sounds easy, but it isn't always easy. And that's really the goal, and I think that's certainly the goal of the health professional side, and it certainly is the goal of law enforcement. Sometimes we don't always agree on how that gets done.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I wanted to point out is that prescription drug abuse is not new.
No, hardly.
Yeah, and I think sometimes because of the OxyContin splashes. I think maybe people have felt, well, this is a new problem. It's been going on for decades. Hydrocodone, as one caller pointed out, is the number one prescription drug of abuse in this country. And it's also probably the most prescribed analgesic. And so a lot of that has to do with that. So it's not a new problem. It's certainly, from everything we can see, is growing for a lot of different reasons. I think the 12 to 17-year-olds are getting to be more involved in prescription drug abuse, an area that they weren't so involved in even 3 or 4 years ago. That's obviously a very disturbing trend also. But if the Federation of State Medical Boards will tell you that less than 1% of physicians in this country are ever sanctioned for anything, and that means not prescribing practices, that means anything. So usually the number of people we're talking about here, the criminal, what I would call the criminal docs, are a very, very small percentage of the physicians in this country.
Presumably, when you start investigating somebody who's might be running a pill mill, you look for the doctors writing the biggest numbers of prescriptions, who would be either operators of pill mills or pain specialists.
Yeah, and exactly right. And it's not necessarily the person who's writing the most prescriptions. You're exactly right. I mean, you're going to expect pain management physicians to write a lot of narcotics. I mean, that's just the nature of the business. It's when you get other specialties or other non-specialties that are way out of whack. But typically, these things happen, how are these folks targeted? Typically, pharmacists have some input. Law enforcement arrests people on the street who will tell you things about different practices. And so we get the information from a number of different ways. And then it requires somebody who's competent to investigate it and try and determine, do we have a legitimate practice or not? And that's something we need to, of course, keep covert, so that we don't ruin somebody's reputation needlessly.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've heard from doctors who say, fewer doctors are entering this specialty for fear of legal problems. And, they've seen others have had their careers and lives destroyed.
Yeah, and I think, again, I have to point out, this is a very small percentage. What happens is when these physicians are arrested, there's a lot of media coverage, and there's a lot of paranoia. I mean, I have gone around the country the last 2 or 3 years and talked to thousands of physicians and law enforcement officers. And there's a lot of paranoia among physicians for the very reason that you mentioned. You know, what we try and do at NADI, or I try and do personally, is to try and make them feel more at ease in the fact that that oftentimes the folks that are targeted are involved in prescription drugs for sex, prescription drugs for illicit drugs, prescription drugs that are done through massive health care fraud. And obviously the vast majority of physicians are not involved in that kind of activity. And we hope sometimes if we can maybe tell them what the things physicians are being targeted for, that oftentimes maybe make them feel at ease, so they write whatever they think is proper and not worry about law enforcement when they're writing a prescription.
Looking on the other side of the problem, though, we did have a caller from Minneapolis who said that OxyContin, a dose to get high, was cheaper than heroin where he lives.
Yeah, it's possible. And by the way, I think you asked about street prices. OxyContin street prices have been about 50 cents to a dollar a milligram. The thing about OxyContin, of course, is people that want to get high don't take OxyContin in the way it's supposed to be taken, and that is swallow it whole as a pill. They're going to chew it up and swallow it. They're going to inject it, or they're going to probably crush it and snort it. So it takes an alteration of OxyContin. OxyContin is not going to give you the rush that drug seekers are looking for unless they break it down.
Mm. John Berkey, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
John Berkey heads the Drug Enforcement Task Force in Ohio and is vice president of the National Association of Drug Diversion Investigators, and he spoke with us from his hotel room at their annual convention in Fort Lauderdale, Florida.